Hi, why don't we go ahead and get started as we do have a lot to cover. And so if we could start just by everyone who's on the phone just stating their name and their affiliation.
I'm Bill Carpenter with the Department of State Health Services Adult Mental Health Division.
I'm Jonah Schwartz with the Medicaid CHIP Division here at HSC.
This is Mark Gold. I'm Special Advisor for Policy at the Department of Aging Disability Services.
Donnie Green with the North Central Texas Council of Governments, representing the Promoting Independence Advisory.
All right, I think that's all we have on the phone. And Elizabeth Yevich and I are here at the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I know I inundated you with information that I was trying to collect and compile based on the conversations at our first conference call that we had for this committee. And so I wanted to hopefully walk through those materials with you to see if we have any other discussion regarding these items, and the main categories are listed on our agenda as the discussion items. So first off, I wanted to, before we started on our big discussion pieces, I just wanted to see if there were any edits or changes to the draft budget recommendations. That was the one pager that I sent to you all yesterday that has to do with our previous conference call discussing what to use our council budget for. And during that previous call, the two main budget recommendations that were given, one was to utilize the funding to hire some type of outside vendor that could help us with the evaluation of the rules and requirements that state agencies have currently that may be potentially generating barriers to the creation of service-enriched housing. And then the second item was looking at an opportunity to utilize funding for local trainings across the state that would educate our service providers and housing providers and would include the production of training materials to be disseminated to those local providers. Those were the two main budget recommendations that I heard at our last meeting. I just wanted to confirm that those are, that in this form we can move forward with bringing these recommendations to the entire council.
That's the discussion as I remember it.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions or concerns with the draft budget recommendations that were provided?
I just think it's great that that we're looking at kind of creating or increasing the number of units that are service enriched for those who need them. Every place I go in the state, whether it's with my PATH program for the homeless or in supported housing services, that issue just is repeated constantly. Is we need more units. We need to figure out a way to leverage resources and people, you know, really feel like they're having an uphill battle when they have to do that or when they're trying to do that.
I totally understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I will then incorporate the service committee's draft budget recommendations into the housing committee's budget recommendations to come up with, just compile those into one page and bring those forward for a vote at our next full council meeting. So that out of the way.
And Ashley, just for my own edification,
yes.
The next full council meeting is scheduled for
Monday, March 5th.
Thank you.
Yes. It will be held at the, and I can send this all out. It's all on our website. It will be held at the T-Shack boardroom.
Okay.
And I was thinking that I would send out to you all the main components of that meeting, even though we haven't gathered all the materials or crafted the materials for that yet, just so you guys know what's on the agenda. Is there any, someone else just join us?
Hi, it's Amy.
Hi, Amy. All right. Well, Amy, we are getting now to the item on the agenda, which is the discussion of community-based service options for persons with mental illness.
Okay.
That item came up at our last call. Particularly, there were two points of discussion that arose around that item. One was HB 2725, which during the last legislative session, it was the legislature asked that the Department of State Health Services, in coordination with HHSC, should study the feasibility of providing home and community-based services to persons with severe and persistent mental illness who have a history of more than one inpatient commitment. And so the department is supposed to issue that report by December 1. And so I did some background, research and digging, and spoke with Dina Stoner, who said that they are hard at work on creating that report. They don't have any information to present to the council at this time. However, she did tip me on to another program that I wasn't aware of, and I wanted to make everyone on the council aware of, because we may want to make recommendations in the biennial plan about this program, which is the outpatient competency restoration pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the in terms of what I provided to you all in a handout regarding that pilot was the basic information about how it started and what it is. So for those of you who are unaware, this pilot started with SB 867 of the 80th legislature, and what it did was it provided funding to four pilot sites originally, which were all behavioral health authorities, local mental health authorities, in which they could help those who had been found incompetent to stand trial and would otherwise be utilizing our state hospitals, and instead try to provide some type of community-based short-term services to them. So basically providing, this was an intensive program of services, but it also included residential placement for housing. And so with this is typically with the local mental health authority providing the majority of this assistance and using their assertive community treatment services for wraparound services. So I was provided this information by Jennifer Swinton and Lauren Lacefield of DSHS, and they also provided me the update for the current biennium, which is that the legislature decided to, in Rider 78, extend the pilot to include another $4 million for each state fiscal year and to include seven new sites for this program. So this seems to be a program that has gotten some steam at the legislative level and is now being extended to more parts of the state. So I wanted to put that in front of you to see if there was any reaction from those of you who have any familiarity with the pilot, if Donnie or Amy, if either of you have had any experience with it in the local community and can speak to the pilot, it may be something that we want to talk about in our biennial plan.
I can tell you, Ashley, this has been a subject more than once, I think two or three times, at the Voting Independence Advisory Committee.
Uh-huh.
And we just had an update again this last meeting in January. So from PIAC and from Promoting Independence, the initiative itself, this is of interest.
Okay, and what are can you give me a summary of what the discussion at PIAC amongst members has been?
Well, it's just been getting updates, finding out what's going on. There's a lot of support for this. I mean, there's a recognition that there's a lot of real positive side effects that result from keeping people healthy and on the road to recovery. So it's just, there's been just a lot of support for this program.
Great. And I don't have any personal experience with the program, but I've heard only good things, and I'm excited that the state is looking at expanding. I am curious in hearing how the replication sites will be selected.
Okay. And I was given in the information from DSHS the list of those awards for the 7 sites. Although I saw that they had been chosen. I wasn't sure how.
It was a competitive bid process, Ashley.
Okay.
Did they do this through an RFP?
Yeah, it was. And Nueces County just received notice at the end of December, so they're working on implementation of it. We've wanted outpatient competency for a long time. The forensic beds in the hospitals are ridiculously expensive, and for us, our closest state hospital is 150 miles away, and most of them even have to go further than that. So, and that all gets charged. Those forensic commitments get charged back to the local administrative authority. So, outpatient competency is going to save a lot to the system as well as be better for the clients that are also using it.
And so, it sounds as though people are. Thinking that this should be something that should continue, and so it sounds, given the fact that this is state general revenue that is being put towards this program, do we have a recommendation for the legislature to continue its funding of this program?
I could check with Jennifer Swinton. This is Bill from DSHS. I can check with Jennifer Swinton. From what I understand, it does provide good cost savings. I think it also supports those assertive community treatment teams or the ACT teams. They have a lot of research that shows that they do save money long term. To start an ACT team often is expensive because your cost savings is usually not up front, but over a 2-year period the savings is there, and if we could support those ACT teams across the state in part with supporting folks in the outpatient competency restoration, that only reinforces my support for it.
And I think, and help me out, Donnie, I'd have to go back to the last Promoting Independence plan. I think there was a recommendation there for ongoing support.
I believe so.
So, from the PIA, see, again, in my function as staff support for that, but not as a representative, I don't know, as a state agency person, we can support, anything, but PIAC in the Promoting Independence Plan, and the Promoting Independence Plan really is a document that really comes from the Executive Commissioner of Health and Human Services, and there was I'm pretty sure I'll have to look that up, that recommendation for this, contingent, of course, upon funding.
Sure. Yeah, that would be great, Mark, if you could get me whatever language that the PIC decides.
I'll have to go back and look at it. For some reason it sticks in my mind. I know we always have something there about increasing ACT.
Right. And I remember that in the council decided to replicate the PIC recommendation in its 2010-2011 biennial plan about ACT support. I didn't know if there was anything specific to this pilot.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and check that out.
Okay, yeah, that would be great. And Bill, I also don't want to forget that, it would be fantastic if DSHS has some information about cost savings here, because that's always what we want to hear.
Right.
For promoting is going to be a cost savings. So if you could speak with Jennifer, and if she has any data. It's always good to have some type of quantitative data to support our recommendations.
I will get that information to her this morning and hopefully have it to you. If I hear her voice in the other room, hopefully have it to you by the close of business.
Thank you so much. That would be fantastic. Okay, so moving on. The other item that dealt with discussion of community-based service options for persons with mental illness was Paula had brought up
looking into the clubhouse model that started with the Fountain House in New York City. And so I just wanted to provide you all the research that I did on that particular model of housing. And what I think is interesting about it is that it ties into, I think, our next discussion about community-based housing definitions and definitions of integration. So the information about Fountain House is really just for your own reference to start thinking about, you know, how you feel about that particular model, and then we can have that data in front of us as we move into the next agenda item. So the next agenda item has a couple of different handouts involved. Two things that I should point out, the first two handouts. First is the Federal Register's information that CMS put into the Federal Register, a proposed rule for the home and community-based waivers, Medicaid waivers. And they were asking for feedback from the state Medicaid agencies. And so then the second handout is what the Health and Human Services Commission provided to CMS regarding that proposed rule. And where this involves our discussion from last week is if you look on page 2 of the Federal Register proposed rules, there under the, in the middle column, there starts a section called HCBS settings, and that section has to do with with CMS seeking public input on the strategies to define home and community-based settings where waiver participants may receive their services. So that section talks a lot about how, you know, they wanted to respond to situations where there may have been interest to use home and community-based service waivers for individuals in segregated settings or settings with a strong institutional nature. They were stating that CMS was stating that that funding is not intended to be used in segregated settings, and they go on to show some of the feedback that's been received as to what that means. And so there was one situation about congregate settings being planned on the grounds of an existing ICFMR and that not being in line with the goals of OMSED. There was also feedback from, it looks like, a parent of a son with a developmental disability stating that the opportunities to use home and community-based waivers for group home settings. So this, I think, ties in with our discussion last time, which is, you know, how does the state and we as a council perceive the definition of integration and the use of Medicaid waivers in the community and how that plays out. So I wanted to provide this to you and get some feedback from you as to, you know, based on CMS's proposed rule as well as HHS's response, which on page 3 of their response, are presenting that Texas supports CMS's philosophy that residential settings must be integrated and not be institutional, and how that relates to some, you know, group home settings or assisted living settings.
Obviously, this is an issue that that DADS and CMS have given thoughtful consideration to. I don't think it's realistic that we would change that, but I would suggest that We just note it as a perceived barrier among some parents and other advocates that they would like the option for folks with IDD in particular to receive services in communities that I'm not sure the appropriate terminology, but communities that are designed for specific populations. And I can kind of play with that.
Yeah. And I can tell you, I mean, there was an advance notice of public rulemaking, and this has been going on for about 2 or 3 years, this particular rule promulgation. It's interesting, we haven't heard back, and this has been what, almost a year ago at this time.
So yeah, the comments are dated June 13th.
Yeah, so, I mean, this has just been a long-term conversation. But I agree with Johnny. I think you just asterisk and note, you know, what's going on here. And CMS may never come up with a definition with this, or what it also said in the Notice of Public Rulemaking was that the Secretary will ultimately write guidance. So guidance sometimes is different than rules. You know, it'll be interesting to see what ends up actually, if they do come up with a rule or they come up with policy guidance from the Secretary. It's kind of all over the map there. And in the conversation, too, there's the recognition that, well, maybe assisted living is okay for an aging or physically disabled population, but it's not okay for an ID population, but then recognitions, you know, that some advocates for individuals with intellectual disability. For example, there's an example here in Texas where there's kind of like a ranch-like setting, and, you know, should we really say people don't have that choice? So it's a very complicated conversation. There's a lot of there's a real split in terms of positions, both for individuals who are aging with physical disabilities versus the ID populations.
And I think that we want to make sure that we have language in the biennial plan that references that there are a variety of positions on this, because I think that perhaps some feedback we received from the public was that in our first biennial plan, we had not had that level of recognition. So I think we definitely need to recognize the split between those communities and what they see as the most beneficial community-based setting to live in for their particular group that they're advocating for, or parents that have children of that have those disabilities. Is there any, I know that, so it sounds like from what Donnie and Mark said that that would be part of what we discuss in our barriers and challenges section of the plan. Is there anything that we want to talk about in terms of recommendations?
What would the recommendation look like or be? I'm having a little trouble there.
And I guess that's, you know, it's something that, given that that CMS does not, at this time, because their rule promulgation period has not ended with the final rule, and given that the Secretary has not provided final guidance, it sounds like that this issue is up in the air. And Mark, can you maybe expand upon, if this issue is not finite, then is it up to each state's Medicaid agency to then create their own definitions in their Medicaid waiver applications?
Well, right. I mean, that's the way we currently act. Each state defines what a qualified residence is for community-based living. Some states allow assisted living, some states don't, some states have certain restrictions. For example, in the state of Texas, We don't allow just any like assisted living facility to be able to contract with the state. We have certain requirements if you're going to contract with the state in terms of room size and egress and having a separate kitchen and all those sort of activities. So every state has their own definition. Jonas and I were in another meeting about, it feels like hyperbole, but kind of the future of long-term services in the state of Texas yesterday afternoon, and we mentioned this a little, we just had a brief conversation that in this other thing, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school, it's called the Balancing Incentive Program, which would allow states to have a additional 2% bump up and enhanced funding as part of the Affordable Care Act. And in there, in this manual, which sort of is like the guidebook towards the future of long-term services, they reference assisted living as a qualified resident. So there seems to be, and we both commented, and if I'm misinterpreting our conversation, Jonas, come in, we both were commenting, well, there's this notice of public rulemaking out there, and yet the BIP, which is a more recent document, is talking about assisted living. So, it's just out there. So I think right now, again, every state through their waiver process, whether it's a BC or a C or an 1115, they get to define, what a qualified residence is.
And I think the way Mark represented all of this is exactly correct. And, I mean, CMS is just struggling with, how to define this for the country if they're going to take such a stance.
Right. And I think that's the good point, Jonas, is if they're going to do it. I mean, they've had just a hue and cry on this conversation. It's very complicated because when they work in Rhode Island, may not work in Alpine, Texas. I mean, it's a hard one. Even though you may have some basic goals that the whole country can adopt, for example, the most integrated setting is the best thing and everything else, what that ends up looking like, the local community is going to have to define that for themselves. So,
and that I think is where I was going with my question, given that that it may need to look different in every state, what a qualified residence is, what a community-based setting is, do we as a council want to have any stance on what we think is best for Texas?
Well, again, and maybe it's self-serving since I had a big part in writing those comments back to CMS, you may want to look at the official response that the state of Texas has already provided to CMS on the subject matter. And I think, if I remember correctly, what, I helped shape was, well, we support the goals, but you've got to allow us to do what makes sense in our community, so...
Yes, and I have that in front of me, as I hope everyone does. And on page 3 is where Scott and I, and given what you just said, Mark, there is a space that says, a paragraph that says, Texas has learned that a variety of community-based settings are necessary to meet the goals, all the goals and person-centered planning choices of those wanting to live in the community. Many want their own apartment. Some want to live with family members. Others choose to live in small group home settings. Some prefer the assisted living facility model.
Yeah, and I think that is the recommendation. I mean, it should be about individual choice. And so you have a menu of opportunities and situations depending on what's going on with any one particular person, with their family, with their spouses, with others in their lives, and they get a chance to make that choice. But their choices shouldn't be limited then. I mean, I think that's the basic argument here.
And Ashley, I do think that we as a council should develop a recommendation and take a stand in our biennial report about, what this should look like. So I think certainly we should have a recommendation to go before the full council for them to... discuss and think about.
And so as the basis of the recommendation, I want to just hear from everyone who's on the phone, would this be stating
in regards to the Medicaid waivers that the state currently provides under 1915C, that the council has an opinion about community-based settings, and their opinion is, and then reference this letter?
Yeah, I think that makes sense, because as I look at the 4 points in the letter, it really seems like 1 and 2 in particular address the issue. The first is to remove regulatory barriers to designing 1915C waivers based on needs rather than diagnosis or condition. And the second, regarding home and community-based characteristics, is basically saying, among other things, recognize assisted living as a viable option. Yeah. And I really think that captures the essence of what parents in the area are telling me, that there needs to be consumer choice, there needs to be family choice, and that they are interested in having some kind of congregate setting available as a valid housing option. They're not necessarily advocating for assisted living, but I think if we go on record as supporting those two recommendations, again, designing the services based on the needs rather than the diagnosis, and two, recognizing, you know, the full array of housing options.
Okay.
Let me just make a caveat and give you an asterisk. That notice of public rulemaking covered two major topics. It's not the housing. It talks about, you know, the issues about defining a qualified community housing placement. But the other part, and really the larger, but that significant part was a proposal to eliminate the diagnostic criteria for the CE waiver. Right now, CE waivers are waived off a specific diagnostic or institutional placement, either ICF or NIF, and this would allow people to do a diagnostic waiver versus that. So in that letter that went to CMS, that covered comments for both of those major issues.
Right. And I apologize, I hadn't been pointing out that other piece only because I was looking at this for the component, but we certainly, as Donnie had just said, utilize both components of this letter and utilize that first component as well.
And also one other just asterisk, when we're talking about 1915C waivers in general in terms of any recommendations, you also have to include the 1115 waiver because the STAR Plus program now is under an 1115.
Right, okay.
And Ashley, just specifically from the Department of State Health Services, we of course support, as most do, the integrative housing for folks who experience serious mental illness. We sometimes realize that may not be available, but we always strive to adhere to the Fidelity tool from SAMHSA's Permanent Supported Housing Toolkit.
And I would like to thank you, Bill, so much, because that is exactly what I was just thinking about. SAMHSA's Fidelity model, which I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, and we can certainly have a conversation about it in the future if necessary, but I think their definition of integrated is slightly different than what within the Department of Housing, what we use as our definition of integrated when we talk about, because we have an integrated housing rule for our programs, and we may need to flush out integration and what the council wants it to mean and what it doesn't want it to mean, because currently, the integrated housing rule, as the Texas Department of Housing uses it for our funding, is that community-based residential living should have only up to a certain percentage of units within any property set aside particularly for persons with disabilities. That's the way that it's stated there. So the integration is based on the property. So integration within a single property. There are other definitions of integration which talk about integration into the community at large. And I think that SAMHSA has typically tended to use integration in that second definition sense, so integration into community at large. So it would not matter then if the majority of units of a property that's being built were set aside specifically for persons with disabilities, as long as that property was integrated well into the larger community. So does anyone see the distinction there?
Yeah, I think it's a critical distinction.
It sounds as though, because if you guys look at the handout I gave you on the Fountain House and Clubhouse model, that model, which is, I think that people would call it a congregate setting because it's specifically designed for persons with mental health or substance abuse issues to live in. So a congregate setting, that Clubhouse model has been adopted into SAMHSA's Fidelity housing kit. Therefore, SAMHSA considers that an acceptable choice for housing that is integrated into the community. However, the Clubhouse model not be an acceptable model for housing that's funded by the Texas Department of Housing as it stands.
Right. Well, and I think that, Ashley, I think it's important because in the substance abuse and mental health, a lot of times that model is acceptable. And I think if you start limiting what the choices are, are you really giving them choices? I think that's why the parents want all of the choices available to them, because really if you say, well, we're going to give you choice, but that means you can only choose from these three things, then you're really not giving them an open choice. And I think we should support the most, that people have the most choices possible, that are possible in the system.
So actually, if we did that, though, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but if we did that, then one of the consequences would be that TDHCA would have to change its integrated housing rule.
You could make that recommendation if you wanted to.
Right.
I would say that just to give you guys a little bit of the, because the integrated housing rule came out of a lot of discussion by our disability advisory work group, the DAW. And just to give you a little bit of a taste of the discussion that's happened around integrated housing rule and why it came to be the way it is that I think there were many advocates for the persons with disabilities that were afraid of having properties built exclusively for persons with disabilities in the community that essentially would then become institutions, just community institutions. I think that they felt as though there were developers in other states that have in other states done that, and the negative consequence is that the developer has not had a concern for having choice and having what most would see as the intention of Olmsted in terms of that residential opportunity for people, and I think has taken advantage of funding in order to basically make community institutions. So that I think, I mean, and I may not be as eloquent as those who expressed that concern at the DAW, but that was one of the concerns that was presented when creating the integrated housing rule. I mean, it can still be, this committee can still make a recommendation on the integrated housing rule. I just wanted to provide some more feedback. Okay.
I guess, Ashley, what I'm, and I'll have to think about this more, but I don't want to make a recommendation from our committee that is in direct conflict with something that TVHCA already has in policy without acknowledging that. So.
Well, and the recommendation doesn't have to say change this rule. It could be very nuanced. It could be talking about, given the different definitions of integration that are being utilized currently by different government agencies, that perhaps a revision could be considered, or you could say something, a recommendation about the conversation being brought back to the Disability Advisory Work Group, right, and having participants that are parents from the IDD community be present at that discussion. I mean, there could be a variety of ways that we go about this recommendation.
Yeah, or even to recommend that the advisory revisit the definition of integration and guard against the full exercise of consumer choice, because I think that's where we need to find a balance between integration and choice.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. I agree.
Okay.
So not necessarily that it needs to go, but just look at whether it might be having adverse impact.
Okay.
That's a good way to find that.
So basically their consideration of the impact consideration.
Because, Ashley, the integrated housing rule has been in effect for several years now.
Yeah, it's probably close to 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, it might be worthwhile just taking a look to see or doing a survey or something to figure out if there has been some adverse impact.
All right.
Yeah, but boy, that's a real controversial topic.
I mean, it would really open a can of worms,
yeah.
But by the same token, I mean, the landscape has changed some in the last 10 years, and so it might be worth a revisit.
And, okay, yes, I know that Mark was there at the beginning when it was formed, so I know he knows that it is controversial, but I agree with you, Jonas, that we can, you know, I think we can certainly make a recommendation about considering how the rule today may have adverse consequences to certain disability populations that have made themselves heard to the council.
Yeah. And, I mean, I advocated for, you know, the passage of that rule. I was in a different position back then, but, you know. So I remember how controversial it was and still is.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you guys for that discussion. Is there anything else on this agenda item about community-based housing definitions and integration that you would like to direct staff to look into more? Anything else? Okay. I will certainly start crafting some recommendations for your eyes to be. I'll make some drafts, and you guys can edit as you see fit. But I'll get started on that. All right. The next item is discussion of staff research assignments. So more broadly, as we continue our process of coming up with topics that we want to prioritize within the biennial plan, topics that we want to make recommendations on, do we have any topics for future committee discussions?
One thing that, you know, maybe we should talk about, maybe I'm asking the question if we should talk about it, is with regard to our homeless population in Texas. and whether we should support initiatives that provide rapid housing for those folks to get them kind of off the streets. We don't really have a lot of research in Texas that proves that that saves money. We can go to Tulsa or San Francisco or New York, which isn't Texas, but they have shown that that saves money to the system as a whole. Now, it wouldn't necessarily save money for HHSC specifically, but it would save money for the system as a whole. Is that something that would be something we would want to discuss, or would we need to put that off to a later date?
Well, I think that should be, I think that's a great idea, Bill. What does everyone else think on the committee?
Given that we heard, you know, in the last round of when we did our public meetings for the first biennial plan, you know, we had a lot of input from that population and people that advocate for those individuals. And so I think it would be worth exploring more.
I agree.
And just to kind of keep you guys in a kind of in the loop, we have a homeless provider in Houston that is currently trying to put together a research project to identify specific cost savings for the persons that she serves who are homeless, and she's working with, or will begin working, I think, with Colin and a few other people, and we may need to dial in some resources to help further that project. But just keep that in mind. There might be some information coming, probably not soon, but at some point in the future.
And when Bill says Colin, he's referring to Rath. It's okay. He is a VISTA volunteer here at TDHCA that is coordinating the Texas Interagency Council for the Homeless, which is a cross-agency organization, but it's, in terms of the staffing of it, it's staffed currently by TDHCA. So Colin has been a diligent and you know, he never ceases to amaze me in his energy towards these types of research issues. He's trying as best he can to bring all of the state agencies together and look at homelessness and how we can quantify homelessness, but also, yes, how we can find out more quantitatively what works and what doesn't work in terms of housing the homeless. So I think that's a great idea, Bill, and I will definitely get in touch with Colin to see what the current status of that effort is, and also see if perhaps the TICH has any information that we utilize on this issue, if they have already collected it.
Well, they're working on their strategic plan, or their plan in homelessness is supposed to be out very soon.
Yes, I do have a copy of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know what I'll do? I'll go back through that and perhaps some of the recommendations that they lay out in the TICH I will bring forward to this committee to see if we want to basically echo those recommendations or if we want to build off of those recommendations for our own plan.
Well, and I think because of the world that I work in, I think that discussion is very worthy. I think you'll find some really different issues. You know, for those of us that deal with homelessness and substance abuse and mental health and some of those things in adults, you know, they do want different options than maybe somebody who has, you know, some the IDD or some of the other disabilities that they're dealing with. And so, you know, I think you can get some really different, you know, that's where a lot of that different choice comes in. You know, when I look at the sober homes and the sober living environments and the shelters that we work with, none of them would qualify as integrated housing under the current rule.
Mm-hmm.
But we send our clients there because that's where they're safe. That's where they get back into the community well. And then they go on to regular housing. But at least, you know, for their transitional time, those meet their needs better than other situations would. So I think all those options are viable options, hopefully.
Okay.
We all know that individuals who are homeless become a real risk in terms of ending up in the Medicaid long-term services system, either through the state hospital system, and then they get discharged. And since they don't have a place to go, they end up in a Medicaid nursing facility if they meet that criteria, and then we spend money in relocating them, and it's just a spiral thing. So this is again, you know, a little bit of prevention and proactive work up front. Perhaps they have a lot of money downstream.
And I think that that is probably the way we want to frame it within the plan, is what Mark just said, because as this plan is supposed to be looking at service-enriched housing, which I think, you know, there's been some discussion of whether or not that would include transitional housing or simply permanent, you know, we're talking about permanent housing, you know, where we lie on how we define service-enriched housing within that scope. I think the way that we want to frame this issue is because we see so many of our homeless getting cycled through these programs without being able to actually achieve that permanent housing that they need, you know, we need to look at ways in which we are assisting them in getting to that final goal of self-sufficiency, which would include some type of permanent stable housing.
Yeah, I mean it's difficult not to talk about this, about individuals who are homeless without looking holistically at the system. So I think it certainly should be part of our conversation. But in the context of, you know, these individuals, not only are there's a lot of vulnerabilities, but just to be cold and hardened when the vulnerabilities is ending up in our system and costing a lot of money.
That's right. And the Department of State Health Services, along with the Texas Homeless Network and providers across the state, are trying to get everybody educated on the SOAR or SOAR disability application process, and hopefully that will begin to move people to a better opportunity to get that permanent housing.
And Bill, can I trouble you with another data request? I would love to know more about SOAR.
Okay.
Because I think that it definitely should be information that we share in our biennial plan. So could you give me some information on that?
I sure can. What I'll do is I'll get you a website as well as the SOAR coordinator's contact information.
Great.
And hopefully I'll give you the thumbnail sketch and he can give you the grand details.
Great. All right. Is there anything else on that topic, or are there any additional staff research assignments? Okay. So, to give you guys an idea of our next steps as a committee, our next committee meeting is 2 weeks from today, February 15th, Wednesday, February 15th. If anyone has any problems with the time.
What time is it?
So we've done all of them starting at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone has any issues with the time, we can always talk about a different time of day.
Okay. I've got a conflict from 10:30 to 12.
Yeah, John, is that our strategic waiver meeting?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so Jonas and Mark have a conflict with that time frame.
I have a standing meeting at 11 to 12 and 8 a.m. to 9:30, so if we want to do 9:30 to 10:30, that works.
Yeah, 9:30 to 10:30 would work right now.
Is everyone else okay with 9:30 to 10:30 on the 15th?
Yes, I mean.
All right, great. Then I'm going to schedule it for that time. And just so you guys know where we're going with this, what I hope to have for you, besides follow up on the research that we've discussed today and recommendations that I'm going to draft, what I hope to have for you at that time is like we did during the last process, a outline of the plan. So what the chapter headings are going to be, the basically the main bones or structure of the plan, so that you guys can see kind of what the framework is, what my idea was for the framework, and then you guys can make edits or comments in terms of adding or editing or removing pieces of that structure. Does that sound like a good idea?
Mm-hmm. Works for me.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, great. So thank you all so much for attending today and providing your feedback. We'll hear from you all on the 15th.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Ashley. Bye-bye.